Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Welcome to Season 5 of And the Writer Is with your host, Ross Golan. Before I give my spiel, I want to acknowledge the Music Army that listens to this podcast every week. Since starting this, the And the Writer Is community has literally changed the history of the music business by helping pass the Music Modernization Act, gotten songwriters added to Album of the Year for the Grammys, and still is advocating for positive changes for our industry on a daily basis. So thank you and congrats. Now, as you know, I've written with hundreds of artists and writers over the years, and my favorite part of each session is the first hour when we catch up about life, the industry, politics, composition, whatever. So this is a journey of learning why people write songs, how people write songs, and most importantly, who the people are who write the songs. I'm producing this with the great Joe London, Big Deal Music Publishing, and Mega House Music Management. If you want to listen to the songs we discuss in this podcast, follow us on our socials, find out about special live events, or buy that merch, aka that hat I always wear, go to our website, www.andthewriteris.com. Songwriters, think about your favorite hit song and what makes it an earworm. You could be the writer behind the next song that goes viral. Enter the 20th annual NSAI Song Contest presented by Martin Guitars and Strings and CMT. You could win several prizes, including the one-on-one mentoring session with L. King, myself, and fellow And the Writer Is producer Joe London. The lyric-only winner will score $2,000 cash and mentoring session with award-winning songwriter Tom Douglas, as well as other coveted prizes. Send in your best songs now through October 31st at nsai.cmt.com. Welcome to And the Writer Is. I am your host, Ross Golan. Today's humble Grammy-nominated, modest multi-platinum, unpretentious songwriting superstar has done the impossible multiple times. The impossible is not the many number one songs this guy's penned, but it's the ability to break an artist, like really break an artist. This is his bread and butter. Whereas others aim for high-floor artists, this guy gets in the proverbial mud, plants the proverbial seeds, and proverbially grows these people from virtually nothing to worldwide music giants. For example, the Chainsmokers and Shawn Mendes, and the future Alec Benjamin and Dermot Kennedy. From the other coast, this understated New Yorker is a mentoring publisher and congenial co-writer and a devoted husband. I'm running out of adjectives and superlatives. And the writer is my friend, Scott Harris.
Wow. That is a lot of adjectives.
That's what I'm saying. Like, I feel like it's we've got like 9 song titles out of that intro.
I'm going to like replay that back and give you a couple songs out of that.
Yeah, cool. I'll take 1%. Okay, so as one of the only last people who still holds on to I'm a New Yorker, what is it like being a New Yorker in the music industry in 2019?
I would definitely be lying if I said it was easy. It feels, I don't know, it sometimes feels crazy, but sometimes is refreshing, honestly. Like, I wanna like be somebody who, you know, artists and writers can come to in New York and feel kind of fresh, which feels good to me. Like when people come to New York and they're like, oh man, like I haven't been here in a while, or like I love the energy here and there's just like not a lot going on. So I kind of can take them for a few days on a little like songwriting journey and somewhat of a break from LA.
Amazing. So how did you start? I mean, well, let's talk. Okay. As I like to say, you were born.
I was born.
Okay. So,
I was born in New York City. I guess I moved to Long Island when I was 3 or 4 years old. My father was a pharmacist, and my mother was an English teacher. And I don't know, I guess I kind of was like, as like a 3 or 4 year old, just like playing the piano, strumming the guitar, and just like writing melodies on the piano and not really trying to figure anything else out. I think that's kind of what like my parents were like, whoa, he's like not copying anything. He's just like making his own shit. And
do you think your mom being an English teacher? I know like Lauryn Hill's mom was an English teacher. And you know, some of these people who are great songwriters come from parents who are teachers, who teach literature. Is that a coincidence?
No, I think there's definitely some influence there. I mean, like more so I was making music and my father is a jazz musician also, and he kind of was like, you know, he saw me playing and like he saw me like kind of starting to incorporate like major sevens and stuff, and he was like, don't do that. Like, I play jazz my whole life. He's like, if you could just like stay away from those a little bit, like it'll be more contemporary. It might actually be a profession. And he's like, and I want you to like really focus on lyrics. He's like, I see you playing music, but like nobody's ever going to listen to you if you don't have words. And like, think from there, like I kind of like took a little bit of my mom's.
He was teaching
like,
you how to write songs even at that point.
He was kind of like, I think as any father does, is like, this is what I did and this is how to take a step into the other direction to maybe make it more of a profession. Not that he like wasn't happy with the music he was creating. Like, it's some of the craziest shit I've ever heard, and it's out there, and it's there was lyrical content to it. But yeah, I mean, the way he pushed me into like just make, he's like, even if it doesn't make sense in the beginning, just have some type of lyrics. He's like, that way, like when friends and family come around, you can at least like entertain them a little bit. No one's gonna like want to listen to you just like play some piano. I guess he like learned that from like being in jazz clubs and people like, you know, having drinks and talking in the background.
Yeah. The talking in the background part is that it's a real, it's not, I know you've been in bands and we'll get there, but have you ever played a show where people just talk over you and you're trying to play like that intimate song?
Never. Really? Oh, man. Oh my God. So many of those shows. I mean, I did, I guess like at the end of high school, or even in high school, even as I had my like my high school band, I started to do like open mic nights as like my singer-songwriter project. And like an open mic night in like the middle of Long Island on like a Tuesday night is like six people. You know, at
six
most.
People, and they're all waiting to go up on
they're
stage.
They're all waiting to go up, and it's like maybe like a couple of your friends are there, and it's like even though your friends are talking through it, you know, and you're just trying to like figure anything out to make anybody give a shit.
What's the first song that's like your song?
First song. I did a song that was like my high school band, which was like, you know, my best friends. And
is this Low Tide?
This is Low Tide.
Okay. So what's the story of Low Tide? Cause that's the first time that we see anything in your, you know, story.
Yeah. I mean, Low Tide is like high school band. I guess like my father had a program called like Acid Pro. I don't know if you remember the program. He didn't really know how to work it either. And I didn't know how to work it either, but he's like, here it is. And it was in my basement with like a little setup with a shitty mic and a piano. And like, I kind of was going down into the basement and just like spending hours creating and producing and writing all this like random, kind of like random, which are like pop songs really. And I guess by the time I was done, like fast forward a few months, there was like 13 or 14 songs that like basically every song was like clipping and like sounded horrible, but like they were pop songs. And that kind of just like showed my friends who were like, one was a guitar player, was like a fish head. And like, I was like, dude, can you just like make it more pop? And like my friend played the drums and he was like pretty good drummer, like never going to be a professional drummer. And my other friend was a bass player. And we kind of just like started jamming the songs that I had done on like Acid Pro and like pressed up a CD, sold it in our high school. And like, that was kind of the birth of Low Tide.
Is it good?
It's terrible.
Really? I mean, not the even the writing part?
The writing, like, there's, like, melodic moments where I'm like, that's nice. But, like, lyrically, it's, like, it's tough. It's I could never listen to that right now and feel good about myself.
It's really strange when you listen to those first things because that's before you know what you're doing, right?
Oh, yeah.
And even when you listen to famous music, like, the radio. If I listen to music from, you know, the early 90s or mid 90s, I mean, probably even through that, I still think of, you know, I still think of it as magical.
Totally.
And so whenever I listen to music now, it's like,
you start thinking
about
it.
You start analyzing it.
Totally.
You know, when did you start understanding that this could be a profession? Or is it way later?
I think it's way later. I think like I still like in high school, like it was fun. I was like, it would be cool to like be in a famous band and be a rock star. But like I was also like, it'd be cool to be on the Knicks. You know, like I had like no idea what I was doing. Like I was like,
I could be a 3-point specialist.
Totally. I know I'm Jewish, but I could be the one. Yeah. I started like imagining it being a possibility, but like never a reality kind of until I guess, you know, after high school when I was like, I should go to college for music. Yeah. But I think.
What was your degree in?
It was actually in music business.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
From SUNY, right?
Yeah. From SUNY Oneonta. Right. I'm actually going back there in a couple of months to like do a little lecture,
which should
be fun.
Congratulations.
Yes. But I really don't know if I learned a ton there, honestly. Like I made a lot of friends. I feel like sometimes I like lost some time in college because I was, you know, partying is super fun, but like taking classes that like don't pertain to anything I do. And like, you can't fully teach songwriting more so than just getting in the room. So even when I work with like newer writers and artists, you know, who are in NYU, I'm like, oh, it's really cool that you're like in NYU and you're like already doing sessions. Like, I feel like I missed like 4 years being like upstate New York smoking weed. Not that I would give that up. It was awesome. But like, there's something about just being in the major city, as you know, to like develop the craft.
Yeah. When you were in college, is that when the Scott Harris Project, or was that also?
Scott Harris Project was like pieces of Low Tide turning into like a solo thing. It was like never, like, I don't think the music was even any different. It was just like, now I'm going to go perform it without you guys.
Who introduced you to the idea of co-writing?
That came like a lot later for me. I wish it came sooner. Like I had been doing Scott Harris Project and like writing everything 100% for a while until like one of the band members was like, I want to try to write a song. And I was like, okay, let's try that. And there was like one co-written song on like, you know, one of the albums for a little bit.
You were releasing it yourself.
I was releasing it. Everything was released myself. Even anything I did in like the Warner-ish deal that I had, like was still like never came out under that.
Explain what that is.
So I met somebody early in my career who was a lawyer who I guess had a JV with Tom Wally at the time. And, you know, basically, you know, on his track record of like, you know, finding some new talent and being the lawyer of some super cool bands, convinced, you know, Tom Wally to let me make a record, pretty much was how that happened. And I guess the whole entire time was like maybe like 8 months to a year of like being in the studio, like kind of trying to figure out what the sound was, which I ultimately think never happened in retrospect. But the best thing ever was honestly when Tom Wally and crew were just like, you know what, just like do your own thing. And I was like, okay, sweet. I don't even know if I like these songs anyway. So let me just like go out and try and do a new thing. And which I just like made a bunch of new songs and recorded them with a friend. And that's actually like all the Scott Harris Project music that's online.
Wow.
Yeah.
Did they fund it, or was it stuff that you were funding, they were distributing?
They funded it. They funded like, I was living in New York. I was like during college, I took a semester off. And they paid for like me and one of the band members to like go out and like live in LA for like, you know, a couple months. And
wow. So I didn't realize you were out here during that.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Where did you record it? Do you remember?
I don't remember what it was called, but I made the music with DJ Lethal from Limp Bizkit.
Wow.
Which was like, I was honestly super excited about, not because I was like a big Limp Bizkit fan, but because like he had done like House of Pain and like Sugar Ray. And I was like, this is a crazy combination. Like, this could be amazing. Like, I'm like a singer songwriter guy. Like, I love, like, I grew up on like hip hop-y shit. So I was like, this could be like the perfect like combination of like what could be cool. And it just wasn't.
Yeah. Man, that like, so obviously this is your story and not mine, but same sort of thing where my first album comes out because I do a distribution deal with a major distributor, and then they funneled it through their system. But during that time is when I met Fred Durst. And Fred was like a big A&R guy, like had signed Puddle of Mud and signed like another one of the big bands I'm sure someone's going to hit me up about. You know, he became like a big A&R guy.
Totally.
Like the guys from Limp Bizkit, you forget that these are... You just, when you're younger, you think, ah, Limp Bizkit. But these guys were savvy, really good musicians and were actually really smart business people. So when those guys are saying, and especially at that time, if he's like, I'm going to help you record, they were the biggest. In
they were huge. And like Fred Durst was like coming by the studio to like listen. And I remember I didn't know any legit musicians. I'd be like, holy shit, like Fred Durst is in the room. Like that like blew my mind at first. Yeah.
Did you ever hang out with them socially at all?
Not really. I mean, I did. I spent a ton of time at the studio, and like, honestly, they smoked so much weed at the time that it honestly intimidated me. And I liked smoking weed, but like, I couldn't. That was when I realized like I couldn't hang and like I shouldn't be smoking, like because they were like just such like. It just like bongs everywhere, and like I tried like a couple times to be like, yeah, I'm like cool enough to like smoke weed with them, because I did like, you know, I did smoke a little bit, and like every time I tried, I was like, no, this shit's too much for me.
How did you ended up touring with Teddy?
I did
during this, which is amazing.
Yes,
but how did that happen? And did you guys spend time together at that point? Like, do you guys realize? It's so weird in retrospect, considering how much you guys have done together.
I mean, we had no idea at the time, but that was kind of like, that was maybe like a year or two after that, after I'd made that like kind of independent album. I'd been working with a new manager who, I guess, hooked me up with like William Morris and started like booking a ton of shit. So I was doing like a lot of colleges and playing a ton of shows and like opening up for a lot of people. And I actually like had opened up for Teddy maybe like once or twice before that tour. And I guess that was kind of one of like the longer tours of the Scott Harris project. And I think the first like, it might've been like 2.5 months or maybe even 3 months. And like the first like month and a half, like we didn't even talk. And then, you know, like the last like couple of weeks we started to become friends. And then I don't think we saw each other for like another like 5 years.
Are you still an artist?
I consider myself an artist in a lot of ways. I don't think I'm like, I have like zero desire to like get on stage and like perform my music at this point. But like, I think there's like artistry in every writer. Like everyone's kind of got a craft, and you know, how they do it is essentially an artist.
Do you write 100% songs anymore?
I don't. Like I do like sit down and write songs, but every time that I think something is good, I'm like, oh shit, I better bring this into a session. Like I never have the urge to be like, I'm going to put this out, but I do try to like be like, oh, can I still do it? Can I, you know, do I want to do it?
Did you ever produce?
Yeah. I mean, I did. I like even like the early like Scott Harris project stuff, I was like kind of co-producing and helping produce. I don't think I was ever like a finisher type of producer. But even now, like in the sessions I do, like I still like end up doing a ton of production, especially like in New York. Like I'll start a bunch of ideas and like pass them on to the producer.
Acid Pro.
No longer Acid Pro.
Right. When you were on tour, did you tour with the, because you said some of them were from, you know, your Low Tide. Are these still, were you touring with friends?
No, this was a couple of like hired musicians / like friends I had met like in the local Long Island scene, yeah, who like just wanted to also be in a band. And they, you know, they saw a little bit of traction going on and, you know, some interest, and the idea of like, you know, when you're younger, just like getting on the road is like an accomplishment. Yeah. So I think, you know, we did a lot of touring like as a 4-piece band, and then they were some good players. And then there was a lot of just like singer songwriter, acoustic guitar guy trying to win over the crowd with one mic and one guitar.
Yeah.
Which I'm sure you're familiar with.
Yeah. I'm still doing it today. When you were, that's really funny. It's like put me in like a whirlwind in my head, like a giant spiral of anxiety. How much did performing in front of people change how you wrote?
Oh, like a ton.
Because that was the first time you had really toured.
A ton. Like I started to write songs like for the crowd and not for myself a little bit. Like I was, especially as like one person and one guitar, I would try to like create moments of like, even if you've never heard me, you could sing this type of stuff. Mm-hmm. Or like, and even if you've never heard me, this concept could be interesting. Yeah. Like I remember I had this one song that I had written, and it was like about a roommate that I had lived with that I didn't like. And like,
is it true?
It's totally true. it was in college. And like I wrote the song, and it just like translated immediately into like the college scene. So I would like open up the set and be like, I wrote this for like a roommate that I really don't like. If like anybody has ever like had that experience, like you know what it's about. And like immediately everyone's like right in. And that's when I was like, wow, I can like take pieces of my life and people will care more so than me like trying to make up a random topic.
Do you teach that to, because you work with so many young artists, do you ever talk about that concept on like what it's like to tour the music that you write?
Totally. Like I even remember like in the very, very beginning of Sean, like some of the earlier songs being like, you know, you could try to have a part like this because, you know, he at the beginning when he was like opening up for some people and he only had like one or two songs, like people knew one song. And I was like, if, you know, we would write parts in there to be like, now the crowd can sing here. So yeah. I think like, yeah, it totally translated.
So what, I don't even know what year we're at right now. Like when you were touring, how long did you tour and when were you done with that?
I think it was probably like, I was like kind of slightly touring in college, maybe like 2006 to like 2005 to like maybe 2010. There were still shows going on. And I think maybe 10 was like the last like Scott Harris show. Something like that.
Were you feeding yourself during any of that?
I was not well, obviously.
Yeah. I mean, it's just an interesting, I just wonder how you make a living as a touring artist.
Oh, there was times where it was like, you know, where I'd open up for like a semi-legit band or a legit band and like I would just like sell tons of merch and that would like last me because I was like taking in all the merch money. So that was like kind of how I made money a little bit. And then I was like also doing like weird, like side hustle jobs, like New York City, like teaching guitar lessons. And like, you know, there's tons of odd jobs that happened in between to like keep the lights on for sure.
Did your parents ever question, you know, let's say, well, you should, you know, keep going cause you're funding yourself, or were they ever like, maybe you should.
This is definitely like a looming topic in my life because my father always was like, never give up. Like he's like, you're too good. Like don't stop. I don't care what anyone says. Like he would have like let me like live on the street before I gave up. And my mom was like, you know, like I really don't want you to like not have any money or like not have a family. Like she was always the one who was like, you could get a degree in something else like while you're still trying. My father was just like, I'm either going to be like the biggest asshole or like be laughing, you know, like he's like, cause I just know it's like inside of you. So like he was the one who was like, you got to. And my mom was like, be smart. And I think when I started to like make some money, my mom was like, oh, like I knew it. I told you. Like I told you to stick with it. You know, like,
it's funny how that happens. Okay, so then, you know, 2010, you're was there a final show where you're like, you know what, this is the last Scott show?
I don't think it was that, but I think I had
it's a hard decision to be like, you know what, I've been striving to be an artist. I've been through bands. I've toured. I've been signed. I've been.
Oh, really, it was like
to say I'm throwing the towel. In LA, there are so many artists who try to be artists for way too long.
Totally.
And they don't have a good grasp on where they are. And there's that fine line of, you know, I'm going to make it someday. And then, you know, they're in their 40s, they're still playing with the same band they've played with for 20 years, and they still are playing the same venue they've played for 20 years, and they still don't have a deal, or they still don't have a hit. You know, it's really hard to throw in the towel and understand that's not giving up on yourself.
That was what, like, I don't know if it was like a defining show, but that was a crazy thing in my life because I think since high school through past college, everyone in my life knew me as like guy trying to like make it, you know? And a lot of people were super supportive. And like, I had millions of friends who like knew all the lyrics and I had legit fans who were reaching out on, you know, MySpace and whatnot. I know we spoke about MySpace earlier. And like, it seemed like crazy to give up that identity. And that certainly was a pretty tough thing to deal with. But because I had not really done a ton of co-writing, like I was kind of like, before the last couple shows, I had been doing a little bit of co-writing for like some other stuff. And I kind of was like more excited about that I had never done that. And I was like, oh my God, like I can make all this music that like doesn't have to sound like a singer-songwriter. And it was like, yeah, I'm like sad in one aspect, but like I'm inspired. I'm more inspired than I've been, you know, like grinding it out, sleeping in the van, you know, like it just seemed like.
Who was opening that door for you?
At the time, I was signed with Mark Jordan and E. McEvely at Rebel One. They had been like doing my artist project with me and helping me out. And Mark at the time was, I think he still is, I'm not sure, working with Alex the Kid. And I think he was like, hitting that success with Alex, where he's like in producer land. And we had been like still like showcasing for labels a little bit, and there was some interest, but it like wasn't the right deal or wasn't the right fit. And he was like, you should like try, you know, writing to some of these like Alex the Kid beats and just see what happens. And I wrote some terrible top lines over those songs, but it like was inspiring to like hear some stuff on like hip hop ish beat and like watch his kind of like rise and watch Mark's rise with Alex and be like, oh shit, like I should get into this. Like this looks pretty awesome. And like, I enjoy it. So that's kind of like how the world started to open.
Do you remember any of those first top lines? Do you have any idea of what those were called? Because it's really strange when you go when you try to write a pop song after writing being an artist, it never works out how you think it is. So you start writing songs that you think are pop songs, and those are not pop songs.
So
I just remember
bad.
Using shorty, all the, like using the word shorty in all those first top lines.
I used shorty. And you can't take it back.
This is amazing. Somebody gave me beats from the guy who was playing keys for Kanye. And it was the first time I had the same sort of thing. It later turned out to be Jeff Basker. And I sent in a song called, it was called like Shorty. Every song on the radio was Shorty This, Shorty
totally.
That. So like, you know, that's what happens when you're aspiring, you chase trends. And then when you're older, you realize, oh, I'm gonna just do what I did the whole time. But I, at the time, I just remember getting an email back through the guy who connected us, Dave Hoffman, if you're out there, hi. And he goes, he gets this email and it's basically like, this might be the most racist song I've ever heard. But I really just was trying to write a pop song. I'm so sorry for anybody out there that I've offended in this. So you know, you go through this experience, it's inspiring, but you're still not writing in the same room. You're starting to write to beats.
Totally. I think from there, I started to like do some more co-writing, and meeting some different people. There was like kind of this little circuit of like New York writers, who we'd like kind of get up and like write to like 4 a.m. every night over like different producers' tracks we were getting. And kind of all became friends and kind of all used shorty together for a few years before we realized that wasn't the way. But like, I think there was, you know, a lot of development in that space, like from the track world, and then being like, wait, like why am I writing to tracks? Like I wrote all these songs on acoustic guitar. Like this is how it's good. Like, why am I doing this? And then it's, you know, it's the learning process of like what gets you excited anyway versus like what's trying to get people excited.
I mean, just looking through your discography, because it really starts in 2011, the post-artist phase, you know, and there's obviously a lot of the trying times in that.
Tons.
But in 2014, you get a Jessie J cut, and that starts to become like, and at that time, she's a big, big artist. Mm-hmm. And it's amazing how you can leverage these things.
Totally.
Even when they're not a single, because I don't think that was a single.
It was not, no.
When did you write your first single? It kind of feels like it was with Sean in 2000.
That was like the first like moment of like single, like in the world, like here's a song that like people like are identifying like more so than you just wrote a song with X artist for sure. You know, there was like, you know, everyone's got like the little victories of like, this song is now doing this and that makes you happy. And then you get another one, you're like, wow, this is what makes me happy. And then you go through that whole chase. But yeah, I think like Life of the Party was the first shocking song to me that like I had no expectation of it really working at all. And like waking up and it like being number one on iTunes and being like, and like when that was like kind of still a legit thing, and being like, holy shit, like it can happen. You know, that was that moment.
I mean, what's crazy mm-hmm. about that, and this is how behind your back I've described this moment. You know, it's like, you know, when you've been writing your whole life, and when I said in the intro the idea of most people aim for high floor artists, and you know, it's like I remember when I got that email of writing with the redhead like acoustic guitarist from the UK, but I had a session with CeeLo and I chose CeeLo over who's Ed Sheeran.
Totally.
You know,
good
and
call.
And it was a At the time, it was like, you know, your fortune, you know, you get in those rooms, and if you can get into those rooms, you go to the rooms with the names. But if you can't get into those rooms, you end up writing with a lot of artists that are on the same level as you as a writer. Mm-hmm. And the risks you took at the time were not necessarily risks. They were just sort of a product of being in New York, and here's an artist who's there. And so, this is the connection that you get from a kid who's on Vine, who had gone around to a couple labels, didn't get, you know, signed to a lot of labels, ends up getting signed to one label, and you end up writing with this kid. There's no way, given the same parameters right now, would you take that same session?
I would love to look you in the face and say yes. I mean, it certainly, I think about that. You know, obviously people send a lot of emails like, check out this. I can open up my email and see seven, you know, this is the next Shawn Mendes, you should check it out. But I certainly listen to all that stuff because I know that there is that type of artist in there. And I think that's kind of one of the beautiful things for me about being in New York, is I get to do that a little bit more. Even on the writer-producer side, like I can take a little more risks because I'm not like missing out on a crazy session for it. You know, I can take a little bit more time. And I think that's also just going back to the New York thing is a little bit of a special thing there too, and certainly how I met some of the writers I work with too.
Songwriters, you could be the grand prize winner and score up to $5,000 in cash, one of 12 Martin guitars, as well as a mentoring session with L. King, Joe London, or myself. The lyric winner will win an opportunity to be mentored by award-winning songwriter Tom Douglas, as well as other coveted prizes. Enter the 20th annual NSAI Song Contest presented by Martin Guitar Strings and CMT now through October 31st at nsai.cmt.com. NSAI, the National Songwriters Association International, is one of the biggest supporters of songwriters and played a major role in helping pass the Music Modernization Act, a historical piece of legislation that allows you to have a future as a songwriter. This is your opportunity to experience industry access, one-on-one mentorship with hit songwriters, and fund your creative passions. Song and lyric-only categories are open now for submissions. We can't wait to hear your songs. And, you know, we were backstage at Saturday Night Live when Shawn was performing, and you had said to me that, you know, your journey is really together. Mm-hmm. And you guys trust each other. And when it comes to even just judging performance or songs or whatever, your careers are so intertwined.
Totally.
At least on the successful train. Mm-hmm. Do you see yourself as a co-writer, a brother, a mentor, a friend?
I think it's, you know, like,
how is your relationship with this person that went, who when you met him was, it's, you know, it's, Shawn the Vine kid to being like...
It's definitely like a brother thing for me, because it's like we kind of just like, we trust each other and we like learn from each other. And it's kind of like, this, because The Rise is kind of like a similar thing. Like I'm brutally honest with him, and he respects me for that, and he's brutally honest with me, and I, you know, and it's just kind of like this mutual thing where, I don't know, it's like, I think you have like certain co-writers in your life where you're like, I really like writing with them. Every time we write, we get something good. And like, for me, like Shawn is one of those people, like regardless of his like journey to the top of the world and how much fun it is to write with like a big artist who's killing the world, it's like we generally click. So it's just like, it's enjoyable no matter what. And I think that's the reason why like he'll like FaceTime me and be like, yo, check out this idea. It's not like we need a session to be like, let's lock in and make it all official. It's like, let's just keep doing what we do.
Right.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Chainsmokers comes out around the same time, maybe a little bit after that. Mm-hmm. And you have Don't Let Me Down, which, you know, becomes their first like number one song. Because I think before that they had Roses, and mm-hmm. I know they had, you know, Selfie. But that's another example where Chainsmokers records this song while they're signed to Republic. They get dropped from Republic, get their masters back, and they move it over. There's no way that the group that does Selfie is somebody that you're banking on is going to be one of the biggest groups of 2015, 16, 17, you know?
Totally.
Being part of that journey, what is that like?
I mean, that's a crazy one too. That one has a lot to do with, you know, also being in New York and at the time, you know, working a ton with Emily Warren. We were writing, you know, 2 or 3 songs a day, every day, like just like nonstop, the two of us, just like figuring out whatever it was. I would pull her into something, she would pull me into something. And that was kind of a day where she had written a song that had come out with the Chainsmokers, I guess like a few months before, and like kind of developed a relationship with them. And she's like, let's just try a day with them, see what happens. And it wasn't a session where I was like, yes, like, can't wait to go. And just like, sure, Emily says they're good. Like, well, let's do it, you know? And I think I don't think even, you know, the Chainsmokers themselves could imagine the life of that song, but, you know, it's just, I don't know, kind of just like happened.
I think there's an important part of this story, and we can talk about it if you're comfortable, but when that song was number one, it was a really hard time for you and your family, mm-hmm. and I want you to explain the meaning of that song. Because even Life, you know,
no,
Life
totally.
Of the Party goes number one on iTunes. It's not the same thing as the biggest song in the country, maybe the world at the time. And the parallel of what was going on in your career versus what was happening at home, I think is important for
people
to hear.
Yeah, no, totally. That was certainly like the most surreal time of my life. It's kind of like as my father was passing away. And yeah, definitely hard to talk about that. But it was kind of like this weird validation of like, because he did see the song go number one after like all these like trials and tribulations of like, how are you going to feed yourself in this career? So it was kind of like him seeing it and being like, you're good. Definitely hard to talk about, but it was kind of like the moment where it all felt like this is all going to work out. And it's very sad, but like, it would be sadder if you missed this. To me, it's kind of how it felt.
It's truly the it's hard to explain. You know, there aren't a lot of things that mark the moment of having a number one song or that, you know, having the success. And you know that if you're, you know, I mean, you grew up in a Jewish family from the East Coast. Like, yep. If you have that kind of song, then you know that if you're smart, you can be taken care of and your family can be taken care of. And most of our parents that are supportive, you know, one of them being supportive, one being kind of supportive, you know, it's that moment where all the people who said like, well, maybe you should look at another job or whatever. And you know, there's always that one or two people who were there for you during the rise that, you know, it's sharing it with those people that mark that moment more than
totally,
you know, chart positions,
totally,
or anything else.
Every time, like, I still have a song like come out or do anything, it's still like I have that in the back of my mind where I'm like, oh, that's frustrating. Like, my dad can't enjoy this. Like, that always comes into my mind.
Yeah, on the other hand, like, if you know, the fact that he saw it
totally is everything.
I mean,
yeah,
even once, you know, it's the fact that it's been repeatable for you is already, you know, super unusual for a human being.
Right.
You know, there's when a song's number one, there are three other writers that can share that moment with you on the planet. That's it. It's not crazy. It's not something where, you know, the label can applaud, the artist can applaud, maybe the artist is one of the writers, but for the most part, the only people who can share it are you and your co-writers at that moment. And that's like the part that's so celebratory. But the fact that your dad was able to see, you know, reaching the pinnacle of a career is, I mean, awards and all the other stuff. That's, I don't know how you beat that moment. Totally. I think that's incredible. I'm
totally thankful that it worked out like that.
When you wrote with Sean for the next album, Illuminate, which was obviously a very big album, because you guys write closely together, are the songs at all based on your life, or are they all based on his, or are they not?
They're trying to be on his, with like, you know, the idea of that people can relate to it, I think. So I think we like draw from his life most of all, but I think there's always those moments where it's like, oh yeah, that's happened to me, and that's happened to this person, and that's happened to this person. So, I mean, what's amazing about Sean is his like desire to be like an old school singer-songwriter and tell stories and tell the truth. And like, I kind of get to help him tell the truth a little bit, and then, you know, see how it relates to the outside world.
Sure.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, at this point he had had Stitches. He had had some songs that had, you know, for himself had been really big. And obviously you guys had have a unique relationship. Treat You Better is really the first song that you guys get to experience together that does what you would hope they all would do at radio.
Totally.
You know, I guess at that point, that becomes also when you're a songwriter and you ring the bell once, you kind of hope that you're not a fluke, if you will. You know, what kind of validation is it to have, you know, this is at that point, you know, your second, third.
That was an amazing moment, not only because of that, but because, you know, I had written a lot of the first album with Sean, and I was obviously super excited that Stitches happened because we were such good friends, and watching it kind of like rise and take over the world was fun to watch, and knowing that we were going to write more songs together like felt good. But like, it kind of felt like validation and like, oh, I'm doing the right thing with Sean. Cause I always like I didn't want to have the feeling like, am I like steering him in the wrong direction? Like, I know he trusts me, but like, that's a pretty big responsibility on this, you know, with given the stage that he's on. So that song to me was like, okay, like we do kind of know what we're doing together a little bit.
Yeah. I think that's fair to say. You know, I don't want to skip too far forward, but during all this, you have Rachel. Mm-hmm. How do you have, it's funny because when you walked in, you're like, oh, you do more than anybody else to me. And I always think, man, no, nobody does more than Scott Harris. You know, at least that's what it looks like. And, you know, how are you able to maintain with all this music that's starting to come out and touring and all the stuff? Because, you know, I mean, you were on tour with Sean too a little bit. You know, how do you maintain any sort of personal life?
I mean, I think we do a good job of, we do spend a lot of time together, like even with a lot of the traveling and stuff like that. Like Rachel does come and hang, and what's really like great about her, other than the million things I could name, you know, and take up many hours of the day, is she tends to have a good vibe with a lot of the writers and artists herself. So it's easy to like, you know, blend the worlds. Like I remember like when Emily was coming over every day, like Rachel and Emily like had and have an amazing relationship where it's like they're friends, they're good. Like I could go do another session and like Rachel and Emily are hanging out. Or and same thing with Sean. Like we'll, you know, make a record upstate New York and like Sean genuinely be like, where's Rachel? Like how come she's not here? Like people want her around, which, you know, I want her around too, but it makes it easier to like when the vibe is right between everybody and doesn't seem like a forced thing.
There's nothing holding me back. Also just a big ass song. Do you start to assume that, do you feel like it's easy?
No, I don't think anytime any song comes out, you're like, cross your fingers and like, who knows, you know, like you're like, it's nice when you have, obviously, as you know, like a bigger artist releasing music, but you never know how it's going to be perceived. So, I mean, it's exciting to have a song like that released into the world. I believed in it. I'm like, this feels like a big song, but, you know, it doesn't, even to where Sean is now, it's like, there's still, you know, there's been plenty of artists that have had big records that like put out a song and just like, it doesn't happen. So sure. I don't think anything is a given in any situation. I mean, that one in particular, like I said, it felt good.
Yeah, totally. Lots of other big songs, some more badass artists. So we're actually with our friend Sam Harris today. We're
love Sam Harris.
Yeah. I mean, obviously you've done a lot with him.
Obviously,
and
that's my brother. Just kidding, that's not my brother.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Have you ever met another Scott Harris?
Not met, but I think like when Facebook first came out, there was a Facebook group of Scott Harris's.
Sick.
So like all the Scott Harris's would like talk to each other on the group. And that's kind of the extent of the Scott Harris's that I know. There was like maybe like 50 of them. And people would be like, I saw your name pop up and you opened up an eyeglass store. You know, like,
yeah, right.
Like little weird like Scott Harris stories.
I'm so glad I asked that question.
I'm so glad I had a good answer.
Okay, so the third Shawn Mendes album comes out. And again, you have, you know, 8-9 of these songs on all these albums, 10 of these songs or whatever it is. Youth comes out featuring Khalid, and obviously that did well. But In My Blood is a whole other level. Not to mention that when everybody's asking for songs that are urban, you know, we need an urban pop song. We need an urban pop song. If I fucking hear that again, I swear to God, you know, it's like, can it be more urban? And here you come out with a song that is not urban in any way, and he's not an urban artist, and he's so relevant. He's relevant to the point of this song having meaning, and it gets Grammy nominated. I mean, do you feel any pressure to follow trends ever?
I don't think so. I mean, that's the biggest lesson in that for me. Like, I think we all like to not, you know, at least talk out loud the sentence, like, we're not chasing trends. And sometimes it just happens accidentally. Like, once you hear that kind of, like, soca groove, it's easy to fall into that type of song that you know is about to happen. But with that one in particular, I mean, that was the first song that we had written for that album. And Sean was the one who was like, it'd be cool to, he was like, he'd just been listening to like, you know, more stadium rock, Coldplay, like Kings of Leon, and like had seen a couple of those shows. And, you know, I'm a big Coldplay fan, Kings of Leon fan. So like, I kind of was able to be like, yeah, like make something like this. And from there, I mean, we had written like probably like 50 other songs after that, but that song was the one where it was just like, whoa, this one means something. This feels like the rock thing. And we had like, the record actually didn't end up being as rock as it intended to be. Like there was like 5 or 6 that sounded like that. And ultimately we're just like, as the record process went on, listening to more music, getting inspired by more shit. And that was kind of the one rock song that hung on and it became like the most special one. And like the obvious one that raised its hand before, you know, before the album came out.
So many people try to, when they're writers, they try to show how much they can write. And that's such an understated melody. Mm-hmm. There's so much space. And it allows the listener to listen to the line, focus on what you're saying, and sing it back for the next time it comes around. Mm-hmm. It's structurally a very mature record,
yep,
for any artist, but everyone's always trying to show their technique off or how many lyrics they can write, and they're so afraid of rests. And that song is just not afraid. It's just sort of
it's in like, you know, after it comes out you look like such like a genius, but like while it's happening you're like, totally. Damn, this has a lot of space. Like, is the chorus good enough? Like, should it start with the chorus? Is that even the chorus? Like, it was like a lot of that during that song. But
some of that is exactly what it is. It's like this confidence game.
Mm-hmm.
And it takes an artist being like, no, this is what I want to say. It's probably not a pitchable song.
No.
I don't know that you get that song necessarily. Well, maybe you would. But I think most people, when they pitch that song, no one would listen to it and feel like it would be competitive. But yeah, if an artist felt like it was theirs, I think that you have a shot.
Totally. I think also it comes from Sean being mature and him doing bigger shows and wanting to be the guy in the stadium. It's like, how do you make songs for the stadium, not just like make songs? And that's song as a result of that too, for sure.
It's back premiere touring.
Right.
It's the same thing. Death of a Hero for Alec Benjamin. I'm bringing up these two particular artists because they feel like they have a similar trajectory as what Sean had. But that song, you know, it's so well written, and it's not like they didn't go to radio with it, but it's the kind of song that people talk about. You're still taking risks on those artists. Do you feel like when you go in with Alec, are you thinking, man, this is, you know, it's a new artist who's...
It kind of depends on the artist. With Alec, I had heard some of his music, and I was just like really impressed. And I like to get to that space where I'm like a little scared, where I'm like, oh man, like I'm gonna try to work with Alec, but I don't know if I can help him. Like he might be too good or may not want to collaborate. It was inspiring. It's like kind of like when you get into a session with like a writer you've never written with, and you get a little bit nervous where you're like, oh man, like, am I going to be able to hang? And, you know, Alec doesn't have like a crazy track record at this point, but I just felt like he was really good. And we had written a bunch of songs before Death of a Hero, but like every single time we had gotten together, I had loved the song and I'd loved the process and thought he was a really, really smart writer. And that was just like, I think he had come to New York for 5 days to do a bunch of music. And that was like the one that stuck.
What about Dermot Kennedy, who's also another one that's on this pretty crazy trajectory?
Yeah, Dermot.
Are you reaching out to these people?
Dermot.
Do they reach out to you?
I think it's like a combination of both. Like with Dermot, it might have been like, do you want to do this session with Dermot? His team wants you to work with him. And I'd be like, oh, fuck yeah, I love Dermot. Like, I love his music, like 100%. Like, and it's not, like you said, it's like not the most obvious session. And like, I had, you know, I'd talk to some friends and be like, have you written with Dermot? And they're like, yeah, like, I don't know if he like likes to collaborate that much. And I'm like, here I am, like scared and intimidated. And I'm like listening to his lyrics and I'm like, oh, it's like this Shakespeare stuff. I'm not smart enough. But like, it's like a challenge a bit to like see what happens when you get in that room. And I think, you know, when you write a good song with somebody the first time, there's always that little bit of magic. And I think with him, that kind of happened with Power Over Me. It was the first song we had written together. I had like just landed in London and like come straight from the plane, like looked terrible. Like he had like come from Ireland on a boat and we're just like, well, nice to meet you, man. And like that song kind of happened and like the relationship kind of developed from there.
Yeah, I think both of those two. If I put my money on two guys, I'd probably put them on them. But speaking of putting money on people, how about Pink? She's a young writer. She seems like she's got some things going on. Those two songs are pitched.
Mm-hmm.
And she has an amazing ability to, when she writes, she writes. When she takes outside songs, she makes it feel like she wrote them. She's incredible.
Totally.
So I had one song with her. I don't know if I realize how big she is. When you see these songs worldwide and you see what they do, did you know what you were getting into with Pink?
No, not at all. I mean, I knew that I was a fan of her like previous music, and I knew that like I had, you know, heard she's had like a million hits over the past like, you know, however long. So it's like an exciting moment of like, here you are like getting to have a song with like an icon, you know, in a lot of ways. So that was exciting. But like I, like you said, until you like look at those numbers and see how people are reacting all over the world, you're like, yeah, this person did not, you know, didn't start their career yesterday. You know?
I mean, she moved so many units, and I don't think people realize she's still like literally moving tons of physical units.
Yep.
And plus streaming and all that. She's just one of the few artists that really have that kind of fan base. But she's earned it. She's incredible. If I Can't Have You is on its way. I think it's number 5 today. It'll probably be number 1 by the time people hear this. Knock on wood. What prevents you from wasting money and buying yachts? Maybe you own yachts. I don't know.
I don't own yachts, but you know, I was like, I just like didn't have any money for so long. You know, like I grinded for so long that I'm just like, I still like feel like it can like be taken away, or like that I still have to work, you know, and I still want to work, and I want to like keep the dream alive in a lot of ways.
Is that why you work so hard, do you think?
Mm, I think I work so hard because it doesn't feel like work. It's like, it still feels like what I want to do. It's fun. Like, I don't think it's triggered by that at all. It's more so like, you know, when I'm doing Dermot, you know, and working on a bunch of songs with them, it's like, I feel like I'm supposed to be doing that.
Do you get envious?
I'd like to say no, but certainly, which I think is like kind of like a lot of artists, you know, that's like an artist thing to like look at other people and be like, oh shit, they're doing this, they're doing this. And I would be lying if I said I didn't have that, but
it seems like the person who's willing to go and write with a bunch of artists that are on their the budding part of their career would have an insane amount of confidence. But I don't know if that's like,
I think like, you know, you even both of you guys know, like you write a lot of songs. Like, you know, like you'd love to think that you're going to get up to the plate and knock it out every time. But there's plenty of times, more often than not, most times you don't. So it's like, how do you ever have the confidence? Like, you know, like you can be confident that you're going to be a nice person and like you're going to be a good vibe that day. But like in terms of like saying I'm going to write an amazing song and like it happened, it's just like, who has that?
How many songs do you write? Because either your batting average is better than you're saying, or you're writing a lot of songs.
I write a lot of songs. I mean, I write a song every day, I think.
You do?
Five days a week.
Yeah.
Sometimes four.
Do you take some time off at all?
I do. And being that I live in New York, I certainly get to be like, oh, maybe I'll only work 4 days this week, or I'll work 3 days this week. So I think that's kind of my, New York is kind of my more off time and more time to like you said, like work with some younger artists that don't have the name yet.
Your publishing company has a total of two writers now? Two writers. And the first one you sign, Amy Allen, you get this. So you get their first two cuts, if this is right, and I guess I'll ask her on her episode when that happens. But, you know, her first single is Selena Gomez, and then right after that is a song, and this might be wrong, but I follow her on social media. I think she posted something where it's like, I think Without You, is that what it's called? Without You, Without Me?
Without Me.
I knew it was one of those. I think Without Me is like maybe set the record for longest song in the top 10 ever. or like for a female artist or something like that.
Some crazy
stat.
Some
crazy
like that, yeah.
Stat like that. That's your first signing. Shame on you.
Yeah.
How did you meet Amy Allen and how do you do that?
Okay, so I met Amy. I knew I wanted to do some type of like publishing entity. I didn't really know what it looked like. But I honestly like started it because it was so tough for me to like break as a songwriter. And I saw some of my, you know, you and other people like, you know, doing this kind of like sign a writer, publish them / mentor them. And like, I always wished I had that. I never had anyone to be like a legit writer to be like, oh, you should go in with blah, blah, blah. I always had like, you know, managers and A&Rs, but it's different when a writer vouches for you. And I almost felt like I wanted to do it. And it felt like a responsibility in a way, because it was so difficult for me to break the doors down. With her, I met her through, it's funny, the same lawyer that got me that first demo-ish deal with Warner. Amazing. And I hadn't seen him. It had to have been like 8 or 9 years. And he like cold called me out of the blue. And he's like, I found out your father passed away. And I just want to say like, so sorry, but I'm so happy you're killing it. And like, I always knew you were going to do something. I told you like just to keep it going. And he's like, why don't you come in for, you know, like, let's just do a hang. And I was like, 100%. This is the first person who like, one of the first people who really believed in me. So I'll definitely go hang, played me some stuff. Amy had like an artist thing that he played, and he was like, maybe you could try some stuff for her artist thing. And I was like, I don't know about her artist thing at the moment. It sounds cool, but she sounds exactly like Selena. Like at the very least, like we come in and like do some songs, and like she, you know, her voice is amazing and her writing seems cool. Develop a little relationship and The rest is.
But how do you? How did you?
I can't take credit for her writing those songs.
No, of course not. But how does somebody? You know, a lot of people ask. You know, how do I get music to you or to a publisher, and you know, or you know, how do I get songs to artists? And for her to go from being signed to you to having Selena and Halsey, maybe two of the biggest female artists on the planet, how did they get the song? Did you send it? Did Zach send it? Your manager?
I think they were a little different. I mean, the Selena one was immediately out of the gate, you know, sent around. There was a couple other writers on the song. It was sent around, like, from the first, like, pass around, like, four or five artists wanted to cut it.
Yeah.
You know, to even on, like, the very, like, early stages, it was, like, one of those where you just, like, knew that, like, it was going to happen. You just had to pick the right place for it.
Yeah. That's fun.
And then I think the Halsey one was Gabs, who it's a joint with APG, and Gabs, who was working with APG at the time, I think sent it to maybe...
Shout out Gabs.
Yeah, shout out Gabs. I don't want to say how the whole thing went down for fear of being, you know, killed.
Right. Don't. Okay, so here we're going to go to the next segment, 5 for 5.
Yeah.
I'm going to name a human, and you can tell me in a few brief words, a word, a sentence, something. Mm-hmm. I mean, I know we've talked about him a lot, but here's your message to him. Shawn Mendes.
Brother. Definite brother.
Emily Warren.
Also, like, family. It's like genius, obviously, you know, songwriting genius, and you know, amazingly gifted, but also like a family member.
Your manager, Zach Gurka.
Zach Gurka. I feel like I should talk more about Zach Gurka. I mean,
he's
my shot. I mean, he's the reason for everything. best friend and also a genius, how he, like, kind of just makes it all happen, you know? And hardworking, smart, and just good at his job.
There's certain people in the business that when you talk to them, you assume that they know more than you just by their, like, persona. And he's one of those guys where when he talks, it's just like, yeah, this guy knows the answer already.
Totally.
I don't know if he does or not, but my assumption is that he just most of the time actually does. But he has this, like, this wisdom that's really, you know.
It's funny because with Zach, and here's my chance to talk about him, he has had that wisdom and confidence since the day I met him when he didn't have a thing going on. Like, he always is like, could have convinced you of anything, and that he'd been, like, working in the music business for 40 years when, like, he didn't know one person.
Yeah, amazing. Let's do Amy Allen.
Also, like, little sister. But it's like the same words. It's like they're all geniuses. Like, she's a songwriting. She's,
hey, it says a lot if you're surrounding yourself around these people.
I mean, like, you know? We wrote a song yesterday, and I'm just like, I get reminded. I'm just like, you like have it. You're great. You know, like, just smart writer, just like talented.
Rachel, your wife. Final one.
Rachel, in one word. Probably like my life support in a lot of ways. Like, the only reason that I'm, you know, more so than Zach here is because of Rachel. I mean, like, she definitely has, you know, she stuck it out. She was down to be with me before I made a dollar. And, you know, regardless of if I would have done music or if I would have, like, gone to law school. By the way, I was never going to go to law school. I'm just saying that. Or if I was going to, like, you know, be a teacher or whatever I was going to do, she would have been down. She just, you know, she thinks I'm talented, but, like, it's not really about that for her.
Well, thank you for doing this.
Thank you.
There are a couple of parts to this. One is that I asked you to do this probably during the first season-ish, you know, just in passing, like, you should do this. And it's amazing what happens if you don't do this podcast, and that you just wait patiently, because since then you've had, you know, three more hits, a hit writer, you know, a number of other things that have happened just because that's the pace that you're on. And so I hope I caught you early enough that we can do another one in a few years, you know, to kind of do our update. But I like that it took a while for us to actually do this. Also, it's like listening to your story is the closest story, a more successful version of what my journey has been. And it's, I think it's the idea of the search of, you know, a lot of people who are maybe our age, you're raised playing an instrument and not a computer. So the idea is like you're going to go and you're going to play music. And if you sing, you're going to sing in public and you'll be the one behind the microphone. There wasn't an idea of co-writing or writing. There's not a lot of information for that for our era.
Right.
And we all ended up touring and trying to find our footing as artists in front of other people. And so to see how well you've translated your history as a writer and an artist and been able to bring that into session after session and song after song. And the reason why those songs are successful are not because of the artists. They're because your experiences in the room, like you personally, you know, you've those artists that, you know, Sean and Chainsmokers and the Alex and the Dermots, like they don't have the wisdom, we'll say, that, you know, that you've developed over these years. And for you to bring that in and so well shaped their careers it's just so admirable. I go and I write with a lot of younger artists, but I've never broken any of those artists. I've been a part of, you know, some of their journeys and been on some of their debut albums, but I've never been the reason why they broke. The songs that I've had that have worked have happened when an artist already has gotten in the door a little bit. Mm-hmm. It's so hard. It's so hard to do what you've done, and you've done it over and over again. And I admire that. And I watch you, and you're one of those people where it's like, yeah, if you're in the room with them, I'm like, man, why don't I get in the room with that? Because the answer is because I haven't done what you've done, and I admire your work. And I you know, obviously I'm a fan of your manager and your collaborators and your wife. And, you know, I'm spending a lot of time in New York in the next year, so it'll be fun to share that with you guys.
Looking forward to that.
But, you know, truly I'm so impressed with your path and your demeanor and all of it. So thank you again for doing this.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening to this episode of And the Writer Is. If you want to hear music from this songwriter I just interviewed, be sure to check out our Spotify playlist or visit our website at andthewriteris.com. If you like what we're doing, please subscribe to us. You can also like us on Facebook and Twitter. And the Writer is produced by Joe London, edited by Miles Bergsma, and published by Big Deal Music. A special thanks to David Silberstein from Mega House Music and Michael White. Until next time, this is Ross Golan.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.